debates and everything that went on, it's fairly clear that the legislature, in adopting the home equity statute and proposing it to the voters of Texas, intended to allow the borrowers to use home equity lending for whatever purpose the borrower intended.
Now, you said this is the first appellate level decision, but every trial court level decision has gone against you. Would you agree?
That is correct, Your Honor. I had the pleasure of being the first written trial court opinion, and most of the others have followed Judge Hanna's memorandum opinion.
In fact, all have, right?
To my knowledge, they have, Your Honor. I believe if you look at the legislative enactment and the constitutional provisions, it's very clear that the legislature was worried about potential abuse by lenders of the home equity process. And in doing that, they wrote the statute to place fairly stringent restrictions on home equity lending in the state of Texas. And that I believe that they did that in two ways. One, and with the court's permission, I'll refer to the statutory or the constitutional sections as Section 50A, which is Section 50A6 and all of its provisions, and then Sections 50G, which is the notice provision of the Constitution. It's our position that
this is a little unusual for the constitutional provision to have all this language in it rather than just essentially authorizing the concept with enabling legislation to follow, isn't it?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. Most of the time, these types of disclosures, at least in property-related cases, are put in the property code as just legislative enactments. But in this instance, they did put the statute or the constitutionally required language in the statute and require that it be given verbatim. Sections 50A6 of the Constitution places extensive restrictions on what type of loan can be a valid home equity loan. And then Section 50G provides a written notice to the borrower that gives in plain, what I'm going to refer to as plain language, certain restrictions that are placed upon home equity lending.
Is it your position that these two provisions are in conflict?
No, I'm not. No, it is not, Your Honor.
You think they're consistent?
Yes, I do. Okay. The reason I take that position is Section 50A6 requires that you meet certain requirements before you have a valid lien. Section 50G covers most of those same requirements, but its provisions actually are more extensive than Section 50A6.
But it's a notice provision that affects the lender's rights to recover on the loan if they fail to strictly comply with it. It's a notice provision as opposed to the substantive provision that actually sets the restrictions on the lender.
I don't see them as being being equal or the same, Your Honor. Section 50A6, what I think has been referred to as the substantive mm-hmm. provisions, you have to meet Section 50A6 before you have a valid lien. If you do not meet those requirements, it's an invalid lien. But the Constitution goes on and provides additional provisions and places obligations upon the lender and has the forfeiture provisions that come into play if those obligations are not met.
So you can have a valid lien under 50A6, and if the lender does not comply with the notice provisions under 50G, then the forfeiture aspect kicks in.
That's our position, Your Honor.
Well, how does that make any sense? You've got a valid lien that you can't enforce. And not only that, you've got to give the money back.
Well, in this particular instance, Your Honor, when the loan was taken out for the Stringers, in our position, it was a valid lien. I'm not going to say that unequivocally because Section 50A6Q is poorly drafted, and that's the section that's at issue here, and it can be interpreted more than one way. But if you assume that they met that provision, they had a valid lien against the home that was owned by the Stringers. However, subsequently, the Stringers, because of the fact situation and the fact that they were required to pay liens that the notice provision says that they cannot be required to, or excuse me, pay loans that the notice provision says that they cannot be required to pay, They notified the lender and gave them notice of the default and notice that they had violated their obligation and gave them an opportunity to cure that.
But they violated it at closing.
Yes, they did, Your Honor.
So they never had a valid lien.
If you interpret the notice provision as being the same as the substantive provision, then it would not be a valid lien.
Well, but let's interpret it your way.
All right.
Did they have a valid lien at closing or not?
Yes, Your Honor, they did.
A valid lien that they couldn't enforce.
Would it was valid until they were, and I'm sorry if I cut someone off.
Please go ahead.
It was valid until the Stringers gave them notice that they had violated an obligation that was part of the loan documentation, part of the extension of credit.
But now let me interrupt you.
All right.
But at closing, it would seem to me that the lender is at closing and tells the borrower, I'm about to give you this check, and we've probably deducted an amount of money that needs to be used to pay off these third-party debts. And, I mean, that's all part of the closing. And the lien is never perfected until it's, in essence, the deed of trust is filed in the county record. So, I mean...
I'm not following your question.
Well, I don't think you ever had... Did you ever have a valid lien here on this property? If, in fact, all this happened at closing?
If you interpret Section 50A6Q the way that the appellee argues that it should be interpreted, which I don't necessarily agree with, but if you do, they had a valid lien until they were given notice that they had violated the obligations placed upon them by the notice provisions or by the extension of credit.
Let me ask you,
yes,
where do you get the, what is the support for your proposition that notice from the borrower invalidates the lien?
It's not just notice, Your Honor. It's notice of the violation of the obligation of the extension of credit, along with an opportunity to cure and the failure of the lender to cure that violation.
Well, under the way you're arguing, it seems, and the way this is set up, this notice is supposed to be given 12 days before the closing, right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
So if the notice is given and it says what it says, and then at closing they withhold funds, the breach is there at that point. Is that
right?
That
is correct, Your Honor.
So why does it take, and it's an automatic breach, isn't it, because, at least under your view, why does it take a demand to make the lien then invalid?
Well, if Your Honor, it goes back to interpretation of this particular section. If you say that the notice provisions, which say that you cannot require the payment of debts to another lender, mm-hmm. if you say that that is the same as Section 50A6, then there was a violation and the lien was not invalid. However, I'm not sure that those two sections have to read the same way, and that was the position that I was suggesting to the court. Section 50A6, if it can be read to say that a lender can require payment to another debtor, or a payment of a debt to another lender. I disagree with that interpretation, but if you read it that way...
Well, that's basically what the Sendance argument is.
That
when
is
you
correct,
look at A6Q, it has two parts to it, but that's where you disagree.
That is where we disagree, Your Honor.
So, if you interpret 50A6 to not allow the lender to withhold from the loan proceeds money that would be paid to third parties, then how could there have been a valid lien at the time the loan closed?
If you interpret 50A6Q in that way, there would not have been a valid lien at closing.
Well, then how do you interpret 50A6 if you're not interpreting it to preclude this kind of action by the lender?
I do interpret it that way, Your Honor, but I'm saying even if you do interpret it that way, my main argument is we need to give some substance to this notice.
So you're saying that 50A6 allows the lender to withhold this fund, that even though it allows it to, because the notice doesn't give notice to the borrower of the lender's right to do that, that the borrower can come back afterwards if the lender acts in accordance with 50A6 and invalidate the whole transaction? I'm very confused by your argument. I'm sorry.
All right. It's our position that 58.6Q does not allow a lender to require those funds to be withheld and paid to third-party lenders. However, that's not the interpretations that were placed upon that by Judge Hanna and the other courts.
Could you walk me through how you interpret it that way? That seems to be contrary to the plain words used.
Are you talking about 58.6Q?
Yes. And my understanding is walk me through your interpretation.
Of 58.6Q?
Yes.
All right. Your Honor? I can come up with several interpretations of this statute depending upon how you read the ors and the excepts. The legislature, whenever they enacted this statute, didn't put much grammar into this particular section. I think Judge Hanna referred to it as being inartfully drawn.
Unfortunately, it's a provision of the Constitution, right?
I understand that, John, and it's the provision that we have to deal with here. I believe to answer your question, one of the possible interpretations is, as suggested by the lender, as suggested by Sendan.
No, I'm talking about you walking me through your interpretation of 58.6Q.
All right.
How can you interpret it from the plain language any differently than Sendan does?
Well, I guess that's where my distinction here is, Your Honor. If 58.6Q, I believe that there was a mistake, as we pointed out in the brief, as to how you would arrive at what that language means.
You're saying the legislature made a mistake when they kept amending it and kept amending it.
That is correct.
And they meant for it to read the same as 50GQ, but ended up with it not reading the same.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's your first, that's your main argument, is that right? That's what you really think happened.
Well, our main argument, Your Honor, is we are relying upon 50GQ and the notice provision that was given to our clients.
But you would agree that the plain language is as Sendan says it is?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, I misunderstood you.
Okay.
Well, then that's the second part of the argument that Sendan makes, is that the notice was given to you in the exact constitutional terms, and which is what is required.
That is
correct. Whereas 58.6Q is the substantive part, and that's what you interpret to determine what rights the mortgage company has.
Well,
I guess the bottom line is, how can you charge the mortgage company with liability when they follow the the constitutional notion word for word?
Well, they didn't, Your Honor, because
they gave you the exact notice that was required.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then they say, but we complied with the subsidy part of A6Q because we have a right to ask you to pay those third-party creditors.
I don't think that 50GQ is not substantive, Your Honor.
So that's where a real major difference is.
Yes, Your Honor. We think that you have to give some meaning to that particular statute.
So that means then we're still going to have to interpret AQ and GQ and look at them and see where they either match up or don't. And did I understand your first statement was that in your view they are not inconsistent?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. But in your view they mean exactly the same thing?
Not necessarily, Your Honor, no.
Okay. So not inconsistent is not the same thing as meaning exactly. I understand what you're saying there.
Right. 50GQ, the notice provision that's required in there, I believe is a substantive provision of the statute.
Go ahead.
I believe it's a substantive provision of the statute, and it needs to be given life by this court. It plainly says that the lender cannot require my clients to pay those debts. The Sendan's argument basically asks you to ignore that section of the Constitution, which I think is improper.
Any other questions? Thank you, Councilman. Court is ready to hear argument from appellee.
Your Honors, I think the court is very aware of what's at stake here for Cendant Mortgage Corporation as well as for other mortgage corporations, mortgage companies, and lenders who made home equity loans in Texas. The possibility of losing, forfeiting their lend position as well as all principal and interest. We believe that Section 50A6QI is the substantive provision and is the provision that should be relied upon. I provided the court with four handouts, which is in this binder, and handout number one sets forth the two provisions, and it may be easier, I'm sure the court has studied this before today, but it may be easier just for comparison as far as that's concerned. We believe that 50A6QI is the substantive provision. It clearly provides two classes of debt which may be required to be paid with the loan proceeds.
But if that's correct, the notice that you're required to give under 50GQ is misleading.
The notice provision, we understand, we believe that the notice provision and the substantive provision have the same meaning. We believe that, yes, one is written in a positive context, 50A6QI, and tells you who you can repay or be required to repay. The other section tells us who you cannot be required to repay, therefore, by implication, who they can require you to repay. We think that they have the same meaning. Granted, the provision, the subsection of 50G is not written very well, but we believe it has the same meaning, and we believe that that's supported just by a reading of that provision as well as looking at the legislative history.
So based upon what you just said, you believe that GQ has substantive effect on this?
I don't believe it is the controlling provision. I think it means the same thing.
But you believe it's substantive as opposed to just some ancillary notice provision?
What we believe is that we were required, the only duty we had with regard to 50G was to give that notice, and to give it in the form as prescribed by the Texas Constitution within 12 days before the loan was made. And if you look at handout number two, and we have marked exactly where 50G begins, you can see that 50G simply specifies that we're to give the notice. We have no other duty or requirement with regard to 50G.
Well, is it right for the highest court in the state to assume that another branch of government was so cynical that they wanted to give that they put in the Constitution, asked the voters to put in the Constitution a notice that in fact is misleading or purports to give rights that aren't really given?
We don't believe that the legislature was cynical and attempted to put something in the Constitution that would be misleading.
Well, then grammatically go through G and show me would allow a lender to make a requirement that another debt be paid off.
Okay. If you look at handout number one, the second section, second provision on this this page sets out who you cannot be required to pay. Cannot be required to pay a debt unless it's secured by the home or another debt to the same lender. The word same lender means the home equity lender, because the whole notice provision is dealing with the relationship between the borrower and the home equity lender. It's talking about what's going on between those two parties. So the interpretation of they can't pay another debt to the same lender means you can't pay another debt to the home equity lender.
The previous position
is you can't pay another debt unless it's secured by your homestead.
Which this other debt wasn't here.
The debt that the Cendant required the Stringers to pay?
Right.
Correct. Third-party debt not secured by the homestead. So by implication telling you who you cannot be required to pay, it is also saying who you can be required to pay. It did not say you cannot pay any other debt.
Okay,
to any
you
other
can pay one secured by the home, but that's not your case.
Correct. It's undisputed that you can pay a debt secured by the homestead.
But that's not your case.
That's not our case. The second section is that you can't, they can't require you to pay another debt to the same lender, meaning the home equity lender. It doesn't say that you cannot be required to pay another debt to a third-party lender.
But that other debt isn't secured by the home, so how can you pay it under this provision?
Well, I think the word, the legislature putting the word or in there means that there were two exceptions to the rule as two classes of debt. And because the substantive provision of 50A6QI specifies the rules and the regulations to, as to how a home equity loan is made, then that section, it lays out that there are two classes of debt.
Okay. Why is it constraint? I'm sorry.
I feel like you're not answering the question. If you would, looking at the language with the word or to the end, ignore that. Pretend it doesn't exist for right now. Answer the question as it concerns the language before that. What we have here is another debt to third party unsecured by the homestead.
Correct.
So why isn't that provision triggered?
You mean why is it, isn't it just limited to a debt secured by the homestead?
Why isn't it triggered in this particular case?
Why isn't it inconsistent with 50A in that case?
Well, we believe that the legislative history shows that, in fact, at some point prior to Representative Wallen's amendments, there was the language ended at the or, right before the or. And it limited the payment to creditors, to requiring payment to creditors, to only creditors secured by the homestead. And then the second class was added.
Well, let me ask you this. Without regard to the legislative history, what's the purpose of the notice provision?
The purpose of the notice provision is to give the consumer information about the responsibilities between the home equity lender and the borrower. And the notice itself, in the title, references 50A6.
But it doesn't notify the consumer what the Constitution says or what the legislative history is. If the purpose is to tell the consumer what the rights are, then why shouldn't the bank be held to the actual notice that's given? I mean, any consumer who would get this would read it the way the petitioner, I think, is arguing that it should be read. And if the purpose of the notice is to inform the consumer of its rights, I think you'd agree this notice doesn't do that.
Well, I think, to answer your question, the reason why Cendant Mortgage should... Cendant Mortgage does not have the duty or the responsibility under 50G to do anything but give the notice. Cendant can't change this notice. They cannot change the language. If they did that, they would have violated 50G.
So it seems like what you're saying is they have the obligation to give the notice, but they don't have to comply with the notice.
They have the obligation to give the notice, and that is the compliance
but
with 50G.
But do they have to comply with the notice by not making a loan requiring the repayment of that kind of debt?
Well, the notice is just that. It's a form of disclosure that was written by the legislature and it's put into the Constitution. The mortgage company can't scrutinize it, does not have a duty to scrutinize that.
That's true, but the borrower can't go look up the legislative history and try to make any sense out of it. Even go look at the Constitution and look at another. I mean, the borrower's going to read this and think, well, happy day, I don't have to pay off all these other... You can't make me pay off all these other debts, and then he gets to closing, and lo and behold, you can.
That's why it's difficult to understand your argument that the two provisions are not inconsistent.
And what is the result if they are inconsistent? What should we do if you've got a notice provision that is inconsistent with what you claim to be is the substantive requirements in the Constitution?
You certainly shouldn't penalize Cendant Mortgage Corporation for following the law, for complying completely with the statute. If you look at 50G, it says this is what you are to do. Give this notice in this form and give it within 12 days of the date before the loan is closed. And that is exactly what Cendant did.
But why shouldn't Cendant be penalized for not complying with the representation that it made to the borrower?
It didn't make the representation. The representation is put into the notice by the legislature.
But that wouldn't preclude Cendant from saying, now, we believe the Constitution says otherwise, and here's what we intend to do.
That's
nothing
true.
To preclude Cendant from doing that.
That's true. In fact, they could have done that, but
what's going to happen, as in one of the cases that was cited in the Texas Bankers Association brief that's ongoing at the state level, that a lender has been sued for misinterpreting the statute. CINDAT really doesn't want to open itself up to interpreting the notice provision when the requirement for them is simply to give the notice.
Ms. Smith,
yes, sir.
Is there, and when I read this, this notice that's required, although it references 50A6, really seems to be a restatement of what the old constitutional limits were. It seems to have the phrase after the or been added by that amendment. It seems to be that it's a notice of what the old law was, which was that you can't be forced to put a lien on your home, and there isn't a valid lien on your home if what the money's used for is something other than to take care of a debt that's secured by the home, which was essentially the old homestead law. You get a lien on the home for the purchase money, and you could refinance and continue the lien,
under
but otherwise, lien's not valid. The only explanation I can have is that this was some sort of effort by the legislature to let the person know 12 days before closing that you're fixing to take out a loan that historically could not be used as a basis for attaching your property. And that's what this looks like, this is saying. Is there anything in the legislative history that's what they were doing?
If you, as far as the legislative history, specifically as to notifying that this is what you're doing, I think what the legislature was trying to do was to put the consumer on notice of the relationship between the borrower and CINDAT Mortgage Corporation. If you look at the legislative history and the bill that I have provided at handout number 4, and you see how it evolved from the initial introduced version where the only thing that could be done or the only loan that could be made would be a loan that was a first mortgage on the home, to the point where we get to page 3 and page 4 with Representative Wallen's amendments, and that is where the language is added to add the or. The additional class of debt that can be repaid by the home equity, that can be required to be paid with the loan proceeds. And I think what's important in that legislative history is that Representative Wallen's first amendment set out the two provisions, both in a negative context, but they added the second class of debt that could be repaid. And then his second amendment changed the substantive provision to a positive context as it appears in the Constitution today. One of the reasons and the justifications for putting this protection or adding this language is to protect the borrower, the homeowner. Because what this does is, this language, by setting two classes of debt that can be repaid by the home equity loan proceeds, one to the homestead lender and one to third-party creditors not secured by the homestead, prevents the home equity lender who may be owed another debt by the borrower, and the debt's not secured by the homestead. It prevents that lender from bootstrapping itself from a position of unsecured by being a creditor unsecured by the homestead to a debt secured by the homestead. In other words, if the Stringers owed CINDAT another loan, unsecured or not by anything, but not secured by the homestead, and CINDAT said, okay, I'll make you that home equity loan, but what I'm going to do is you have to pay off this other note that you owe us. Well, that was the home equity loan lender is precluded from doing that, and that protects the borrower.
Do you have any statements by legislators or reports or constitutional analyses that shows that was the purpose of this language, or is it just something that makes sense?
I believe in the amicus brief filed by Long Beach Mortgage Corporation, there is reference to the transcript. I can't tell you exactly which page that is on, but Mr. Young does speak to and quotes
the various debates that went on between Wallens and Representative Wallens and I believe Representative Dan Burke. But that was one of, and that's what this statute does. It actually precludes the home equity lender from putting themselves in a better position than it was in when it started out before it made the home equity loan.
Ms. Smith, I'm still unclear about something. I understand your position is that while the language may not be the easiest thing to read, that 50A6 and 50GQ are consistent and not contradictory.
Yes, ma'am.
If that's the case, and you read as in 50A6 that they can be required to pay debt to another lender with the proceeds, I am unclear about how you interpret the first clause of 50GQ. Why in this case isn't the debt that the Stringers were required to pay to third-party creditors not within the meaning of the first restriction in the notice provision, that you are not required to apply the proceeds to another debt that is not secured by your home? I'm not understanding how that clause is to be interpreted, because it seems to me on the facts of this case, it covers it.
All right. So what you're saying is you believe that the first provision is all-inclusive, that if your debt is, if you are required to pay off any debt, it has to be debt secured by the homestead, and that's all you can pay off.
That, I just want to understand how you, I mean, when I just mm-hmm. read that language, that's the conclusion that I reach, and I understand you're telling us it means something different, and that clause does not cover the Stringers situation. And would you please explain that further, because I'm sorry, I'm not getting it.
Okay. I believe that the first exception, just like in the substantive provision, which it was to track, and that is one of the purposes, is for it to track 50A6QI. The first provision provides that you cannot be required to repay a debt that's not secured by the homestead, so meaning you can be required to pay a debt secured by the homestead lien.
Mm-hmm.
When the word and or was used, another class of debt was added. Now, again, it's in the negative, and it says that you cannot be required to pay a debt to another lender, another debt to the same lender, meaning the home equity lender. There would have been no reason to add that provision and the word or if the intention had not been to add another class of debt that the home equity lender could require to be repaid, because otherwise they could have just stopped at that point.
Well, it could mean that the lender in the first instance already has a lien on your home, and they're requiring that you pay that down in some way. I mean, that's one construction of it, where you don't...
That is one construction of it, but I think if you look at the legislative history and the way it changed, the provision would have been maintained as it was introduced, if that was the intention.
Well, we've got this language in front of us. It's pretty
yes,
specific.
Ma'am.
How do we get around it?
Well, I believe that there are two things. It has the same meaning if you look at it from the position that it's telling you who you can't repay, so it's also telling you who you can repay. And if the legislature intended for it to be limited to only being allowed to repay debt secured by the homestead, they wouldn't have added the word or.
But the legislative intent here is sometimes very important in interpreting a statute. And if we get it wrong, the legislature can come back and redo it. But the fact that this is in the Constitution, and whatever we say, it's still going to be in the Constitution until it's amended, and lenders are going to have to give this out to everybody. It seems to me that we have a very strong obligation to try to interpret plain language here and what the Constitution means, don't we?
Exactly.
Because
certainly,
this isn't just something to let, if we messed up the, mm-hmm. what the, we're not really, when we're interpreting a statute, we're trying to get at what the legislature meant. And sometimes that means an interpretation that's contrary to the plain language occasionally, like in Bridgestone-Firestone case. But here we're not really trying to get in their head because this is a notice that goes to
every potential borrower here, and we need to get at what the plain meaning is.
Certainly, Your Honor, and that's why we believe it has the same meaning. It has the same purpose, to create
but lenders aren't getting A6Q1.
Well,
they're not getting that language and saying, we're going to give you a notice. It's going to be what's in the Constitution, and what it means is it's consistent with this.
I understand that, but I think that it also says, by being written in the negative context, you can, the consumer can also interpret what it means in the positive context. It's telling you who you can't be required to repay. It's also telling who you can be required to repay by exclusion.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Is your forfeiture remedy also in 50Q?
It is referred to in
50GQ.
It is referred to in both sections also, Your Honor.
50A as well?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Was there also a DTPA claim in this case, or was it just pure forfeiture?
It was strictly a forfeiture claim. Your Honors, as I see it, this court has three courses of action that you can take. One is to follow the plain language of 50GQ, which is given to the consumer, and hold that a lender cannot require the payment of third-party debts that are not secured by the home.
Let me take you through this just a minute to look at the remedy here for a second. 50G says you've got a valid lien if you give this notice, and they gave it.
Yes, Your Honor.
So then what?
At that point, Your Honor, 50G also places some obligations on the lender.
In the notice or otherwise?
In the notice, Your Honor. And also, there may be other obligations placed on the lender as part of the loan documentation. For example, the lender there may be escrows for insurance and taxes and things of that
nature. But doesn't the 50G is written kind of curiously. It says you give this notice and you've got a valid lien. Senate gave the notice.
That is correct, Your Honor.
They've got a valid lien so far.
Yes,
but you say they violated the provisions of the notice. Then what happens?
At that point in time, Your Honor, they are subject to the notice and opportunity to cure provisions that are part of the forfeiture proceeding, and which was followed in this case. In other words, in our instance, the Stringers notified the lender that they could not require them to pay off these debts and gave them an opportunity to cure that violation of the Constitution. If the Stringers had not cared, they would not have given that notice. Once they gave that notice, the lender has an opportunity to cure within a reasonable period of time.
The Constitution?
Cure their violation of the obligations of the extension of credit.
Under the notice?
Under the notice provision,
which is inconsistent with the Constitution.
It's part of the Constitution.
It's inconsistent with 50A6Q.
Well, I don't say that it's necessarily inconsistent. We're not taking.
My question is, how could you cure with regard to A6Q or cure with regard to GQ1?
Cure with regard to 50GQ with the notice provision.
You paid the $106,000 to the Stringers plus whatever else is provided.
That is correct, Your Honor.
But A6 says that the lender can require the owner to pay debt to another lender.
Right. Yes, Your Honor.
So how could then they have violated the constitutional, the substantive provision of the Constitution to put them into this forfeiture situation by taking an action that the Constitution allowed them to take?
Well, I guess my problem is I have a difficulty saying any part of the Constitution is not substantive.
If I accept your argument that the notice provision is substantive, and we know that they complied with the notice provision, and then you say, well, they have to come back and cure. And the question was, well, what are they curing? What provision are we looking to in terms of curing? They're not curing the notice because they complied with the notice. Now you're complaining that they should cure sure the act of requiring them to use part of the proceeds to pay off the third-party debt, but A6 says that the lender can require them to pay debt to another lender. So I'm not sure where we're left.
We're curing the obligation that was imposed upon the lender by the notice provision.
But how do you square that with A6 if you agree that A6 allows them to use the, require that some of the proceeds be used to pay debt to another lender?
If this court is trying to say that 50GQ and 50A6Q have to read the same way, then our, you know, my position is I'll adopt the argument of opposing counsel and say, if you say that lender is the home equity lender and you read 50A6Q using the term home equity lender, they will be consistent.
What if they're, you're taking the position in following up with what Justice Heck was walking you through, you're taking the position that there's some inconsistency.
I'm taking the position.
And what I want to know is where the lender is left if they've complied with the notice provision and then they get this demand from the borrower to cure, and they're now faced with another provision in the Constitution that says they can do what they did in terms of the actual action that occurred at the closing where they withheld some of the money or required it to be paid to the third party.
Right. The difference in my mind, Your Honor, is the fact that 50A6 deals with when the lien is invalid at the beginning. 50GQ deals with obligations that are placed upon the lender in this particular circumstance that we're talking about here. I think it would be very, to adopt the language, very cynical to say that we are going to give a notice to a borrower that says you can't do it and then turn around and interpret it to say that you can do it or that the lender can do it.
But your forfeiture provision is at 50A6Q10?
If I can look down, it's also in 50G. It's also referred to in 50G.
It's part of the notice.
It is part of the notice, and it's also part of 50A6.
But where, just can you look quickly and see if it's Q10?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, you're asking me.
If it's Q10.
Are you in the provision of the notice provision or 50A6?
Yes, 50A6Q10.
What page is that on?
Z849.
That is correct, Your Honor. It's on page 20.
Okay, if it's 50A6Q10, the substitute provision says the lender or any holder of the note for extension of credit forfeit all principal interest if the lender fails to comply with the lender's or holder's obligations under the extension of credit within a reasonable time. That's the part you've been referring to.
That is correct, John.
And you're taking the position that the notice provision forms the lender's or holder's obligation under the extension of credit.
It is a part of the extension of credit, Your Honor. It is given to the borrower as part of the loan process, and I believe that it is part of the extension of credit.
But it would have to be part of the obligations under the extension of credit for the forfeiture provision to trigger.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
I just have one final question.
Yes.
In 25 words or less, you said we could do one of three things. You talked about one that involved a cure, and we won't go down that road anymore. Well, what are the other two things we can do?
Well, the other two is to try to read the two sections together.
Okay, let's throw that one out.
And
what if we find they're totally inconsistent?
I think the third way is to basically ignore the notice provisions and the information that's given to the consumer and basically tell the consumer, we're telling you that we can't do it, but we can do it.
Why doesn't the, if the notice goes out 12 days before, the consumer reads the notice the way you say it's read or the way consumers are being led, they show up at the closing, the lender says, okay, we're going to close this loan, here's how we're going to do it. Why doesn't at that point in time the consumer walk away? I mean, instead of going ahead and closing the loan, allowing the funds to go, with the lender saying, I know the notice provision said that, but we can do this under the statute, why should the consumer be allowed before they close the loan, because they're going to know at that point in time they're not getting all the money that they thought they were going to get, and then they get to come back and invoke the forfeiture provision. Why isn't the borrower under some obligation at that point in time to say no thank you?
Well, Your Honor, the borrower at that point in time may have made obligations to use those funds for other purposes. And
but they've had notice for 12 days. They can't do that.
That's right. The borrower, the consumer has had notice that it can't be done if they show up at closing expecting the funds and those funds are cut in half, or approximately in half, as in this case. If you're in need of the funds for a purpose...
But you're not getting them anyway, because the lenders held them back. So, I mean, what good is it going to do to go forward and close the loan?
I mean, it seems to me that then it also, from the consumer's perspective, is a gotcha kind of... It's a gotcha on both ends, it seems to me, given the arguments that are being made today. Because the consumer says, well, I have these other obligations I was intending to pay, and the lender says, well, no, you're not getting the money anyway. But the consumer chooses to close the loan, knowing they're not getting it all, and comes back a week later and says, now I want you to forfeit everything. So,
well, that's not what the consumer says. The consumer says, you could not withhold those funds. Give me those funds.
And they don't do it.
And then that forfeiture provision comes in.
I know, but they know at the point in time before they sign on the dotted line they're not getting the money.
You may want to...
Right?
It's not in the...
I don't know. I mean, I'm asking.
I hate to state outside of the record, Your Honor, but excuse me. When I close a lot of real estate loans, and the borrowers get there, they will oftentimes agree to things because of plans that they've made that they would not have agreed to if they had had an opportunity to plan around. Now, that's obviously...
Not had an opportunity to what?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Not had an opportunity to what?
If they have not had an opportunity, if they had known ahead of time, they may have applied to the loan to someone else or tried to take the loan out to someone else. But,
well, but
show
that's
up
Justice Hankinson's point. The constitutional provision also provides the notice has to be there more than 12 days before the closing. So any consumer that's seeking a home equity loan has 12 days to look at it, get a lawyer, and say, this looks like a gotcha to me. I don't want to do it. So they don't have to do anything. Rather than, as she suggests, waiting, closing, deduct it, made, and then make it a complaint.
Well, the notice says that they can't do what they did at closing.
I understand.
So the consumer's not going to complain in that 12-day period.
But they know when they get there that they're not getting $227,000.
In this instance, Your Honor, my client knew it when he signed the settlement statement. That
yes,
the time
exactly.
He knew.
And why can't he?
His plans thwarted in some other way.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the arguments for today. The marshal will adjourn the court.